Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a resident, and this is episode 143 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I will be essentially giving a comprehensive biostats review for the USMLE exams. I will say essentially this podcast, if you're taking any exam of Step 1, Step 2 CK, or Step 3, I strongly recommend that you make sure you go through this podcast. I'm actually attaching slides, and I would highly recommend that you download the slides and maybe annotate them as I go along. But this will be a very, again, like I said, very comprehensive review. The only thing I really would not talk about in this podcast is bias. Bias is something I think probably deserves its own podcast. So I'll probably make a podcast in the future relating to that. And just as a pro tip for people taking, for people taking the USMLE exams, whenever you get the drug out questions, you should always leave them for last in the block. I'll just say for the great majority of people, it usually makes no sense for them to try to do those drug ad questions first. Once you see it, just mark it, just mark those questions and move on, come back to them later. And then the other thing I want to say with regards to biostats is do not, because I see many people, they're just like, oh, biostats is a plug and play science. And they say, oh, yeah, I've memorized all the formulas. And then you're like, man, why are you doing so poorly on these biostats questions? The thing is, to be perfectly honest, it's not very common for you to have to do extensive math to arrive at the answers to most USMLE biostats questions. Most of them just kind of depend on having a thorough understanding of what's going on, like having a thorough understanding of the concepts. Usually that gets you all of the way there for the most part with many of these questions, because most times they ask you about relationships, they ask you about patterns, things that are not necessarily abstractable by just memorizing the formulas. So you will notice today, in fact, to be honest with you, and again, I'm not saying this from a point of pride, I'm just telling you what I do. I essentially never set up 2x2 tables for most biostats questions. Don't get me wrong. For some biostats questions, you know, you do need to, you know, do some math, right? Things like likelihood ratios and stuff like that. But for like maybe like 95% of biostats questions I do, I usually do not do any kind of math or set up like a 2x2 table or anything like that. Most times, if you kind of like understand the concept and really know, like not just like, oh, I know the formula, like really understand what the concept speaks, typically, the answers are pretty obvious on MBME exams, right? So my goal with this podcast is to teach you how to think about biostats. I essentially want you to feel like, oh, biostats is pretty easy. I actually feel like I have like a very good, solid understanding of this. And for people that are taking the Step 3 exam especially, you better know your biostats. I will say probably like one out of every like 5 or 6 questions you'll meet on day one of your exam is going to be a biostats question. So don't blow that stuff off. It's a recipe for disaster. And then this podcast, I will also say it's probably very useful for people that are taking like the internal medicine in-training exam and the internal medicine board exam, because they tend to test a lot of these concepts relating to like biostats. They test them in very unique ways. And I think this podcast should also make you very well served to deal with those kinds of problems. So without further ado, I'm just going to go ahead and jump into it. And I love the way I structure this. I have like questions, like really like 90% of this presentation is based on questions. So again, by sort of walking through these questions, I really do think it will give you like really by the end of this podcast, I think you should have a very, very solid basis for biostats. The thing I will just say though is this is one of those podcasts you don't want to speed through. Again, I'm saying this as someone that watches many things at 2.5x speed or 2x speed sometimes. But really, for the most part, you probably don't want to speed through this so that you don't lose the thread of thought. Okay, but try to really make sure as you're going through these slides, try to make sure that you're really understanding what's going on. As you listen to me, make annotations. And I think at the end, you should feel very comfortable with biostats. So let's jump right into it. So question one. So a new serum test is created to screen for peripheral arterial disease. the sensitivity of the test is 80%. The most accurate interpretation of this statement is, so, a new serum test created to screen for peripheral arterial disease, sensitivity is 80%. The most accurate interpretation of this statement is what? So, option A, patients with positive test results have an 80% chance of having the disease. Option B, in patients with negative test results, 80% do not have the disease. Option C, in patients who have the disease, 20% will have a negative test result. And then in option D, patients with negative test results have an 80% chance of not having the disease. So what do you think the right answer here is? I would pause if I were you. So the right answer here is actually option C, right? The right answer here is option C, right? And if you kind of think about it, right? Like the thing is, again, like I said earlier, answering MBMA questions for the most part, especially the biostats questions, I mean, yeah, you can do math to get to the answers, but most times you don't really need math to answer these questions. Many times you just need to think and you can usually finagle your way to the right answer. And sometimes, like even with knowing the formulas, I see some people, they're like, how do I even set up the math in the first place? If you don't have the understanding, it'll be hard for you to set up the math. Or if you set up the math, you set it up wrong. Okay, so just something to keep in mind, right? So the thing is, sensitivity, when you're dealing with the concept of sensitivity, you're essentially trying to answer this question. You're essentially asking yourself, of all the population with a given disease, what percent have positive test results? That's literally all sensitivity deals with. Of all the population with a given disease, what percent have positive test results? Once you figure out that percent, you've essentially figured out your sensitivity. The thing is, the other percent that you don't detect that truly have disease, those will obviously be your false negatives, right? And if you notice, the second word in false negative is negative, but the word in front of it is false. So that means that if it's a negative that is false, that means it is in fact true, right? It's in fact a positive. Right. So one thing I recommend, especially to people that I tutor one-on-one, I tell them to consider using like this second to first word mantra to keep things straight. Okay. And another thing you want to remember here is that when a test is highly sensitive, it tends to have a low false negative rate. You kind of see the way the ends match with that. So looking at the other answers, right? So answer choice A is wrong, right? Because it says, oh, patient with positive test results have an 80% chance of having the disease. That's essentially describing the positive predictive value, which I will get to in a bit. Option B says, in patients with negative test results, 80% do not have the disease, right? Again, that's essentially expressing the negative predictive value. So I'll talk about that in a bit. And then option D says, patients with negative test results have an 80% chance of not having the disease. Again, that's just almost like moving the words around for option B. Okay, so again, biostats, I promise you, it sounds nebulous, but it's not hard if you just really try to understand what's going on. Now, the next question. So a study is done on 1,000 patients with a history of glioblastoma, so GBM. A new serum test, and the name of this test is ST, is done to screen for recurrent GBM. 100 patients have a positive ST test, and 900 have a negative ST test. Brain imaging with biopsy, so this is obviously like a gold standard test, is done on all these patients and 30 recurrences of GBM are found. 10 patients with positive ST tests have GBM and 20 patients with negative ST tests have GBM. Which of the following best represents the sensitivity of ST tests? So I'll just read this real quick again. So study 1,000 patients that have a history of GBM. New serum test, the serum test is ST. You do it to screen for recurring GBM, right? 100 patients, they have a positive ST test. 900 have a negative ST test. And then you do like a gold standard test, right? So like brain imaging with biopsy. And you do it on all these patients and you find 30 recurrences of GBM. And of those 30 recurrences, you notice that 10 patients with positive ST tests have GBM, like the GBM recurrence, and 20 patients with negative ST tests have the GBM recurrence, right? And then I'm asking for the sensitivity of the ST test here, right? So option A is 92%, option B is 35%, option C is 75%, and option D is 50%. So what do you think the answer to this is? So the best answer here is actually B, right? So the sensitivity here is actually 33%. And I'll talk about, I guess I'll sort of go ahead and mention it now. So the thing is, you may say, but Divine, there's no 33% as an answer choice. So here's the deal, right? So don't blame me, blame the NBME. The thing is, occasionally the NBME actually like does this thing where they put answers that are not completely exact with the math. They just put inexact answers that are kind of close to what the real answer is, right? Whenever you see this happening, you're like, man, I've done this math twice. I'm still getting the same answer. Pick the answer that is closest to the answer you spit out from your math, okay? And again, this question sounds really hard and nebulous with all these numbers. But again, if you do simple math based on an understanding of the concept, it will save the day for you here, essentially, right? So the thing is, sensitivity essentially tries to answer the question, right? Again, like I said, of all the population with a given disease, what percent have positive test results, right? What percent have positive test results, right? So the total disease population is 30 people, right? That's made very clear in the question. And then the number of those, like the number of those disease people with positive test results is 10. So like 10 of those people had like the positive ST test. So your sensitivity is essentially 10 over 30, which is 33%. Again, you can go ahead and plug this into a 2x2 table if you want. But again, I don't think that's absolutely necessary. If you just understand the concept, this is essentially what I do, like on my own on exams. And the answer here is 33%. Okay, so let's jump on to the next question, right? So we have a new serum test for GBM, okay? Has a specificity of 90%. The most accurate interpretation of this statement is what? So option A says 90% of patients with GBM have positive test results. Option B says 10% of patients with GBM are missed by this test. Option C says 10% of patients without GBM have positive test results. Option D says 90% of patients without GBM have positive test results, right? So I'll let you mull over that for a second. So what do you think the answer is here? So the best answer here is actually C. Okay, again, simple math plus understanding is the way to go with biostats. And really just in general with any subject on the USMLEs, understanding is usually the way to go, right? So again, kind of like I talked about with sensitivity, specificity essentially answers this one question. This is how you should try to interpret sensitivity. Of all the population without a given disease, what percent have negative test results? Again, of all the population without disease, what percent have negative test results? That's literally all you need to worry about, right? So in the question, I tell you that the specificity of this test is like 90%, right? So that means of all the people without GBM, 90% tested negative, right? So that means there's this 10% that should have tested negative, but they ultimately ended up testing positive. Essentially, these people are false positives, right? So that's why the right answer here is C, because option C says, oh, 10% of patients without GBM have positive test results, right? Those are your false positives, okay? And kind of like I said that, oh, a highly sensitive test has a low false negative rate, right? You see the ends kind of matched there. A highly specific test, on the flip side, also has a low false positive rate. You can see how I kind of highlighted both P's in the PowerPoint. Okay, so let's take a quick like sidebar here, right? You've probably heard of this spin and snout principle, right? So let's talk about it, right? So the thing is, if you have a test that's like, you know, super sensitive, like a very highly sensitive test, people that have disease, just sort of walk with me through my thought process here. If a test is highly sensitive, it means that people with disease should have a positive test result. That's what you'd expect, right? On the other hand, if a test being highly sensitive like comes out with like a negative result, so if the test result says, oh, negative, then that means the disease should be absent, right? Because again, this is kind of building up on things I've sort of talked about already, right? If the test is negative, the disease should be absent. That essentially tells you like essentially you're dealing with a low false negative rate, right? So a negative test should help you rule out disease. That's where the snout principle comes from. That if a test is highly sensitive, that's the SN, right? It should help you rule out disease, right? But if you look at things from the other perspective, right? If a test is like highly sensitive, then that means people without disease should have a negative test result, right? Now, the thing is, if you are like, oh, okay, this test is, you know, very specific, people without disease, negative test result. If you get a result that is positive from this highly specific test, then that means that disease should be present because this highly specific test has a low false positive rate, right? So a positive test should help you rule in disease. That's where the SPIN principle comes from. So for a very specific test, that's the S, if positive, that's the P, should rule in disease, okay? Unlike the SNAL principle where the S is a highly sensitive test, that's the S, if negative, that's the N, should help you rule out disease. And this kind of leads into my next point of like screening versus like confirmatory tests. The thing is, again, if you have a test that has very high sensitivity, like I said earlier, again, you may say, Divine, you're repeating yourself over and over again. Repetition always helps, trust me. So in tests with high sensitivity, right, people that have disease, they should have positive test results, right? So a high sensitivity test, it actually makes a very good screening test, right? Because you don't want to inadvertently like miss out on people that have disease, right? So take, for example, if you know you're screening for HIV, you want a test that is very high sensitive, right? So that you don't miss out on anyone that has HIV, right? Because imagine what will happen if you miss out on a person that truly has HIV. They go out into the world, have sex with other people, give those other people HIV, right? That's not good, right? So you want to try to prevent that. That's why you use high sensitivity tests for screening, right? That's why essentially for HIV, we use the ELISA test. The ELISA test is extremely sensitive for the detection of HIV. But if you have a test with very high specificity, people without disease should have negative test results, right? That's what you'll expect. So the thing is, these high specificity tests, they're actually awesome at confirmation. They are very good confirmatory tests, right? Because the thing is, you don't want to like wrongly label people without disease as having disease, right? So the thing is, these tests that are, again, very highly specific, they're good at labeling people without disease so that if you get like, you're like, oh, this test is very specific, it's a high specificity test. If you get a positive result, right, and you know by definition already, I've hammered this point home over and over again, you know by definition that a high specificity test has like a very low false positive rate. If you get a positive result from a very specific test, then that patient very likely has the disease. Right? So this is why if a person has a positive ELISA test for HIV, you don't like run out into the room and tell the patient, oh, you've got HIV. Well, you should probably say it, you know, in a more patient-centered fashion, maybe a more subtle tone of voice, but that's a different story for another day. But after you do the ELISA test, you don't tell your patients the results just yet, right? The next thing you do is you do a Western blot, right, to confirm. Right, the Western blot, you do them after a positive ELISA, right? Because again, there is nothing that feels as terrible as telling a patient, oh, I'm sorry, you have HIV, and then you go and do the Western blot and you're like, oh crap, this patient doesn't have HIV, right? You would not want to do that. That kind of looks like a lawsuit waiting to happen, so you don't want to do that, right? So although I guess with that said, remember, the Western blot is no longer what we do in most places to confirm a HIV, at least in the US. Okay, so let's jump to the next question, right? So question 4. So which of the following points best represents the region of the graph with the highest positive predictive value for the detection of type 2 diabetes mellitus? So I'll encourage you to look at the graph and then tell me what you think. What is the region on the graph that represents the highest positive predictive value for the detection of type 2 diabetes? Okay, so the right answer here is actually D, right? So the thing is, these questions, they're like super, super, super annoying, right? But let me just essentially tell you the trick that you should follow, right? The thing is, you should always try to have a frame of reference. When you have a frame of reference, these questions are cake, right? So here's what you should always think about. The region that has the highest positive predictive value will be the region that has the highest specificity, okay, and that will essentially correspond to the region where you do not miss a single person that does not have disease. I'll repeat that again. The region of the graph that has the highest positive predictive value is the region that has the highest specificity. You see how the P's match? The P in PPV, the P in specificity. And I mean, think about it, right? You say that a test has, like, for example, 100% specificity. If all the people that don't have disease get a negative test, so you're essentially looking for the region on the graph where you do not miss out on anybody that has a negative test. And if you look at this graph, right, on slide 10, right, you see that there's the part of people that that don't have disease. So the right answer here should be C. Because again, if you look at this graph, right, you notice that the blue line sort of tells you, okay, these are all the people that do not have disease, right? They don't have any disease, right? And if you look at A, like B, if you look at B, the point B on the graph, you know, it has most of the people that don't have disease, but it doesn't have all of those people. But if you look at C, everything to the left of C includes everyone that does not have disease, right? So that is the region of the graph where you have the highest specificity. So that's the region of the graph where you should have the highest positive predictive value, okay? That is essentially the region of the graph where you absolutely do not miss out on anyone that does not have disease, okay? Again, remember, positive predictive value essentially means the percent of people with positive tests that have disease, okay? So positive predictive value means the percent of people, right? So it's basically like the question you answer when a patient like meets you and says, like, let's say you give a positive test result to a patient. If the patient asks you, but doc, how sure are you that this result is correct? Essentially, that patient is asking you about the positive predictive value of the test. Like, oh, okay, of all the people that have positive test results, what percent of them are correct? Which of them actually are like real, true positives, right? If you see that, you're dealing with a positive predictive value, okay? So again, very, very high yield to make sure you understand these things. And kind of like a quick sidebar so that you don't, again, mix this up on exams. Let me try to buttress this point. The sensitivity of a test, right? I said this earlier, represents the percent of people with the disease that have positive test results. The sensitivity of a test is the percent of everyone that has disease that they get tested, they get positive test results. Positive predictive value of a test is the percent of people that have positive test results that have disease, okay? That's the percent of people with positive test results that have disease, okay? Do not mix this up. Percent of people with positive test results that have disease. So again, please, please, please don't mix this up. Like if you switch the words like before and after, like who have, you essentially get the right definitions for both of these things, okay? But please, 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 I'm begging you, try not to mix this up on an exam. So let's jump to the next question. So question number 5. So which of the following points best represents the region of the graph with the highest negative predictive value for the detection of type 2 diabetes mellitus? Right? So which of the following points best represents region of the graph with the highest MPV for detecting type 2 DM? So the answer here is B. Okay, the answer here is B. Right, so remember again, this question's super annoying, but again, not very hard, right? Because essentially the thing you're looking for on the graph is the region with the highest NPV, right, is the region that will have the highest sensitivity. Right, is the region that will have the highest sensitivity. Kind of see how the ends match, right? So that's essentially the region of the graph that does not miss anyone with disease, right? Once you remember this, you're pretty much set, right? So if you look at this graph, right, you see the red line kind of shows all the people that have disease. If you chose C, yeah, you'll miss very few people that have disease, but you're missing some people. We want like the part of the graph where you don't miss anybody at all that has a disease. That's where option B comes in, because everything to the right of option B, those people all have disease. I really hope this makes sense, right? Again, remember, NPV of all the is essentially like the percent of people with negative tests, right, that do not have disease. Okay, those are things, again, you want to keep in mind. And again, you see this next sidebar. Again, please don't mix this up, right? If you notice, I'm kind of like trying to draw parallels and keep things as uniform as possible, right? Specificity, I already talked about this earlier, is the percent of people without disease that have a negative test result. That's it, right? But NPV is different. NPV is the percent of people with negative test results that don't have disease, okay? Those are two things, they sound very similar, but they are very different. And you can already begin to opine that your friends at the MBME want to write questions where they mix and match those words around to try to mess with your head. Do not fall for that. Remember Divine saying, do not fall for that, okay? Make sure you really understand what these terms mean. So let's jump to the next question, right? So we have a clinical trial is conducted to measure the effectiveness of the IM test. So it's a test, I'm calling it IM test, as a screening tool for the detection of testicular cancer. So 500 IM tests are obtained. 20 men have positive IM tests and are found by testicular biopsy to have testicular cancer. 180 men have positive IM tests and are negative for testicular cancer by biopsy. 290 men have negative IM tests and are negative for testicular cancer by biopsy. 10 men have negative IM tests and are found to be testicular cancer positive by biopsy. What is the negative predictive value of this test for the detection of testicular cancer? So I'll let you mull over that for a second, and then we'll talk about the answer. So the correct answer here is actually A, right? The correct answer is A, right? So again, you see people, they see these questions, tons of numbers, they begin to hyperventilate. You do not need to do that. Again, the key thing is ask yourself, what is the quantity that's being tested? In this question, it's the negative predictive value. And then the next thing is you define it, like you use like the logical definition you have. You sort of write that out and then say, okay, so what are the numbers I need to fulfill this definition I just wrote out, right? You bring out the numbers you need, and many times this should get you to your answer, right? So notice there are all these numbers in the question, right? But you look at, like, again, I can already imagine people like setting up these 2x2 tables. Again, you don't need to do any of that crap, right? You really can reason through these things and make your life a lot easier and go through questions a lot faster, right? So if you look at it, like I said earlier, negative predictive value is of the people that have negative tests, what percent don't have disease? That's essentially all you're trying to do. The percent of people with negative test results that don't have disease. So all you need to do is ask yourself, oh, okay, who are the people that had negative test results? Well, there's 300 of them. So that's in your denominator, right? And then of those people that had negative test results, how many of them do not have testicular cancer? It's 290 of those people, right? It's 290 because the question clearly says 290 men have negative IM tests, but they are negative for testicular cancer by biopsy. Biopsy is like a gold standard test here, right? So you essentially just do like 290 over 300, and that's 97%, and that's it. Notice I did not set up any 2x2 table or anything like that. And you may say, Divine, no, that's not how it works on exams. I promise you, if you really dedicate yourself to understanding these things, this is how these questions work on MBME exams. So let's jump to the next one. So if the cutoff for a positive IM test result for the detection of testicular cancer is 5, which of the following best represents the outcome of adjusting the test cutoff value to 1? Right? So if the outcome for a positive IM test result for the detection of testicular cancer is 5, which of the following best represents the outcome of adjusting the test cutoff value to 1? So option A says PPV would increase, so positive predictive value. So PPV would increase, but NPV would decrease. Option B says specificity would decrease, but sensitivity would increase. Option C says PPV and NPV would both increase. Option D says sensitivity and specificity would both increase. So I'll let you mull over that for a second. You can pause, try to work it out. Okay, so let's talk about this, right? So again, like I said, define the quantity that's being tested, right? And then essentially like come up with your own answer in your mind first before you then start looking at the answers. Because the thing is, I see many people make this mistake on exams, and it's usually like, it's essentially not a great way to take tests in general. But looking at the answer choices first, before you look at a question, it just begins to mess your mind up. It begins to sway your mind in like every which direction. And then you end up getting confused, right? And then you start making assumptions when you're reading the question. So this is where you need to be careful, right? Like, analyze what is being tested in the question, and then you go after your answer, right? So look at this question, for example, right? Like, the prior cutoff is 5, right? So it's like, oh, if you have an IM test value above 5, you have testicular cancer, right? Think about it. If you bring it down to 1, right, you're essentially setting yourself up for a situation where you would catch every single person that has testicular cancer. It's like, if whatever lab value just rises a smidge, just goes like above 1 by any stretch, you're like, boom, you have testicular cancer. So the thing is, you will essentially not miss anyone with testicular cancer. So if you think about it, if you're not missing out on anyone that has disease, that means your sensitivity must be going up, right? Your sensitivity has to be going up. And the thing is, whenever your sensitivity is going up, then you already know right off the bat that your NPV will go up. I already talked about this earlier. Remember, the ends match. As your sensitivity is going up, your NPV is going up, right? And the thing is, as your sensitivity is going up, believe it or not, your specificity comes down. Okay, so your sensitivity and specificity typically go in opposing directions, although that's not always true, but that's beyond the scope of our discussion here today. And then PPV and NPV, they typically also go in opposing directions. Okay, so the right answer to this question is actually B, right? Because the specificity is decreasing, but the sensitivity is actually going up, because you're essentially not missing out on you're not missing out on anyone that has testicular cancer. Yes, you may say, Divine, but by lowering it to 1, you know, yes, you're catching everyone that has testicular cancer, but you're also like catching a lot of people that do not have testicular cancer. That is absolutely right, right? That is absolutely right. So the thing is, whenever you try to make a test like super sensitive, you also get you also get a lot of false positives. So I know some people may already begin to get a little confused with what I just said. Remember what I said earlier. I said that if a test is very sensitive, if you have a high sensitivity test, it has a very low false negative rate. Okay, a high sensitivity test, right, has a very low false negative rate. You would actually extend that knowledge a little bit further and tell yourself that a high sensitivity test has a very low false negative rate, but it also has a very high false positive rate. If you're a test that is super sensitive, you're also going to catch a lot of people that the test calls them positive, but they actually do not have disease. Okay, so that's kind of like the trade-off for getting a very high sensitivity test. That is why whenever you do a screening test that is highly sensitive, you also want to do a confirmatory test that is highly specific, so that you can weed out that big number of false positives that you're getting from being able to catch every single person that has disease. Because a highly specific test has a very low false positive rate. So you're essentially using the low false positive rate benefit of a high specificity test to counter the high false positive rate side effect that you get with a high sensitivity test. I really hope this makes sense. Again, I'm taking my time because biostats is like a sore spot for many people. So I want to make sure that you're essentially an expert by the time you're done with this podcast. Okay, so now let's jump to the next one, right? So a medical student at Johns Hopkins, that was actually my alma mater for medical school. So a medical student at Johns Hopkins invents a drug that improves survival in patients with glioblastoma multiforme, right? So GBM, by 7 years, right? Which of the following changes will be seen a few years after the drug is approved by the FDA, right? So option A, the sensitivity of screening tests for detecting GBM will decrease. Option B, the prevalence of GBM will increase in the population. Option C, the positive predictive value of GBM detection tests will decrease. Option D, the incidence of GBM would increase in the population. Option E, the specificity of screening tests for detecting GBM would increase. And then option F says the negative predictive value of GBM detection tests would increase, right? So I'll give you some time to sort of think about that. So pause the recording and then try to come up with an answer. So let's walk through this, right? So we invented this drug, right? That improves survival in patients with GBM. So it doesn't cure. So read your questions carefully on the exam. I'm not saying that we're curing anything. No, we're just saying that it improves survival in patients with glioblastoma by 7 years. I mean, as some of you already know, GBM is a horrible disease, right? Like most people that get GBM, the median survival is like 14 months. It's like the worst possible kind of brain cancer a person can have, right? So the thing is, you've invented this drug. By essentially inventing this drug that improves survival, you will effectively keep more people that have already been diagnosed with GBM alive, right? You'll just keep, like they've been diagnosed with GBM, but they're able to live longer because of this drug. So the thing is, because people that, are, you know, they've been diagnosed with GBM, you're keeping them around for longer, the prevalence of GBM in the population would increase, right? The prevalence would in fact go up. Right? Because if you think about it, even if you get like a new person that gets diagnosed with GBM, let's say, oh, ideally they will die with, like ordinarily, I'm not saying ideally, I never want anyone to die, but pardon my English there, right? But like, let's say usually people that get GBM die in 6 months, right? But if you give them a drug and then they are living like 7 years or thereabouts, then that tells you that, okay, like the number of people with GBM will begin to accumulate. Because yes, you are not changing the number of new people. Like it's not like, oh, by giving this drug, you are reducing the incidence of GBM. No, people will still get GBM at the same rate. But when they get GBM, they live longer than they used to live before. So the prevalence actually goes up, right? And the thing is, as prevalence goes up, the positive predictive value actually goes up as well, okay? So as prevalence goes up, the PPV actually goes up. So that's why option C is actually wrong, right? And the thing is, remember I just told you in the previous question that PPV and MPV are inversely related to each other. As the PPV goes up, the MPV should go down, okay? So that's why option F is wrong, right? And again, remember, when you change the prevalence of a test, it doesn't really do anything to the sensitivity or specificity of that test, right? So that's why options A and E are, you know, flat out wrong. The only things that can change the sensitivity or specificity of a test is if you like change the actual test. So let's say like the previous question, I think it was like a question or two ago, where I actually like changed the cutoff value for the test, okay? So again, you'll still be diagnosing GBM at the same rate, so the incidence really does stay the same. And kind of like as a sidebar, right? Again, you may ask, like, Divine, why does the positive predictive value increase when the prevalence increases? Well, stick with me here for a second, right? The thing is, let me just give you a simple scenario that should clear this up pretty easily for you. So think of it. If you have a patient, you know, they come into the ED in December and they have, you know, like fevers and rhinorrhea, so like runny nose, and they have like myalgia, so like everywhere hurts, right? They likely have the flu, right? The thing is, if you did a flu swab on these people and it came back as negative, would you really believe those results? You probably would not, right? Because you're like, oh, come on, man, this thing looks like classic influenza, right? So the thing is, the prevalence of the flu goes up in December, right? So if a test result is negative, you don't believe it. That's like an easy way to remember that the negative predictive value actually goes down, right? But if the test is positive, you're like, oh yeah, I mean, I kind of knew this before I even did the test, that you for sure have the flu, right? So you are more likely to believe the results of a positive test, right? You are more likely to believe the results of a positive test, right? So that's the thing. You are, if you're taking it another way, like you are less likely to believe the results of a negative test during a high prevalence period for a disease, okay? So, again, stated another way, right? If a disease is common, you are more likely to believe that the result of the test is positive. Okay, again, I know I'm repeating things different ways, but again, I just want you to feel super grounded in biostats by the end of this podcast. And again, as I kind of alluded to in the question, right? Incidence, it's the number of new cases of a disease that, you know, have been diagnosed within a specific time period. So new cases, that's the name of the game, right? And then prevalence is essentially the number of people that are alive at a given time period. So you define the time period and say, oh, how many people are alive that have a certain disease, right? At that time period, that's the prevalence. So let's go ahead and jump to the next question. Okay, so question 9. So an M2, so like a second year med student, so an M2 researcher at the Gifted Medical Student Institute plans to study the effects of consuming high amounts of kale on the development of pheochromocytoma. He plans to publish the results of his study prior to graduation. Which of the following study designs presents the most appropriate means of completing the study? So option A says a randomized control trial. Option B says a prospective cohort study. Option C says a crossover study. Option D says a case control study. And option E says a case report. So pause, try to come up with an answer. Okay, so let's walk through this, right? So if you think about this, the phenomenon that this researcher is trying to, you know, work on is super, super, super rare, right? It's super rare. I mean, like pheos, as common as pheos are in exams, they're actually not that common in the real world. I mean, like, I remember, like, at most of these major medical centers, they may see, like, one a year or one in 2-3 years, right? So, pheos are very uncommon, okay? And the thing is, this is a second-year med student, so he probably has, like, you know, like, 2-3 years before he graduates. So, the thing is, if this student said, oh, you know what, I want to, you know, do the high-impact study, do, like, a prospective cohort study or do, like, a randomized control trial, the thing is, it will literally take this patient like 60 plus years to get like me, if not more, to get results of from this study. Because again, pheos are super rare, and chances are, before you find a person that consumes kale, and you're able to then establish that, oh, you know what? Yeah, this kale really played a big role in this person getting a pheochromocytoma. Again, that would literally take like a ton of time, right? That this med student does not have. So the thing is, the concept here you want to understand is, if you're trying to study like quantities that are rare, like rare phenomena, you almost always want to do case control studies on MBME exams, okay? Because the thing is, when you then get some, you essentially, like, you know, you take people that have pheochromocytoma, you take people that don't have pheochromocytoma, but are very like similar in characteristic, right? So like they have similar ages, similar like environment they lived in, like similar comorbidities and all those things. And then you ask them, you look back to the exposure to kale in the past, right? The thing is, when you, you know, do this study, you can then use that as the basis for like a more detailed study, like a randomized control trial or like a cohort study, right? The thing is, many times doing case control studies provides the impetus for you to generate a new research question that you can then pursue with a more formal, a more rigorous, study design, like a randomized control trial or like a prospective or cohort study. So the best answer to this question is actually option D. So again, case control studies, again, you need two groups, right? And they need to have similar characteristics, right? So group one, they should have the disease in question. Group two should not have the disease, right? And then you just go back in time and ask them about the exposures, right? The thing is, you can already begin to imagine that there'll be a lot of recall bias, right, with these case control studies. And again, you want to make sure that you remember, and I'll talk about this later, you want to remember that the data you get from case control studies, for the most part, are odds ratios. I'll talk about odds ratios in a bit. So let's jump to the next question, right? So we have a professor and two medical students that undertake a case control study over the course of a year and publish their results in a high impact journal. So let's say like New England Journal or JAMA or whatever, right? Now, which of the following best represents an example of a possible conclusion from their study? Okay, which of the following best represents an example of a possible conclusion from their study? So option A says, duloxetine decreases pain scores in patients with fibromyalgia. Okay. Option B says, a combination of sofosbuvir and ledipasvir cures hep C with high fidelity. Option C says, asbestos exposure causes mesothelioma. Option D says, orsodiol administration improves survival in patients with primary biliary cholangitis. So if I were you, I'll pause and try to come up with an answer. So let's talk about this, right? So If you notice, so the right answer here is option C. I'll just say that right off the bat. The thing is, if you think about it, right, like the researchers, they essentially like to look at people with mesothelioma. Like if you're looking at option C, they essentially took people with mesothelioma and then compared them to people without mesothelioma, right? And then they likely, you know, determine that, you know what, oh, there are all these people that have mesothelioma. They seem to have like a history of asbestos exposure. Maybe they worked in shipyards or whatever, right? And then based on that, you can then say, okay, let me do like a prospective cohort study of some sort, right, to follow people that work in shipyards to see if they have like an increased incidence for the development of a mesothelioma, right? The thing is, you may say, but Divine, why are options A, B, and D wrong? The thing is, those other answer choices are wrong because they essentially involve interventions, right? I mean, look at this for a second. Option A says, duloxetine decreases pain scores in patients with fibromyalgia. Well, how did you determine that? You must have given patients the duloxetine and then measured something, measured pain scores, okay? Or like combining sofosbuvir and ledipasvir cures hep C. Well, the thing is, you must have combined, you must have given those people hep, not giving them hep C, that'd be weird, right? You would have given those people those drugs and then determined that, oh, like did some blood tests and determined, oh yeah, these people have actually cleared their viral load, right? Also dial, same deal, right? So those options A, B, and D all involve interventions, right? So chances are they are likely wrong, right? So again, notice, this is a question that's like, oh, everyone knows what a case control study is, right? But I'd be willing to opine that a decent number of people may have struggled with this kind of question, right? So again, it's very important. You need to try to understand, like if there is any one thing you take away from me rambling, I mean, I would want you to take away biostats from this. But if there's one thing you can take away that would really help you, like literally for the rest of your test-taking life, and even just in patient care, is to try to make sure you understand concepts. The thing is, if you understand concepts, you typically will do very well on exams, regardless of how difficult the questions may seem. Okay? So that's just something I want to leave with you that will really, I feel like it can almost like change the course of your test taking life, like going forward, if you can really like abide by this principle. So again, kind of like to summarize here, right? Again, the case control studies, the cohort studies, they deal with exposures, right? But randomized control trials, they deal with interventions, okay? And if you notice, I put the word detour here. I just used it to remember to talk about what these studies are, right? So case control studies, right? Again, like I said, I already described them. People with disease, people without disease, right? And then that have similar characteristics, and then you look back in time and say, oh, okay, ask them about the exposures, see if there are any like exposures they were enriched for in the past, right? A cohort study is where, you know, you identify two groups of people, one group has a risk factor, the other group does not have the risk factor, and then you just follow them in time to see if they develop a certain outcome, right? And then you calculate a relative risk and all that stuff from there, right? And then a randomized control trial is you take an intervention, okay? You give it to one group, and then you give the intervention to one group, and then you give like placebo to the other group, and then you try to compare outcomes, okay? So again, those are kind of important things to know. So let's jump to the next question, right? So the average normal CD4 count is 1,000 per millimeter cubed of blood with a standard deviation of 100 per millimeter cubed. Which of the following best represents the normal percentage of individuals who will be measured to have a CD4 count greater than 1,200 per millimeter cubed of blood? Option A says 2.51%. Option B says 95%. Option C says 5%. Option D says 16%. And option E says 68.2%. So pause, try to come up with an answer. Okay, so let's talk about this, right? So really the big thing you want to realize with this question is that 95% of the population, right? For a population that has a normal distribution, they should fall within two standard deviations of the mean, right? So the standard deviation here is 100, right? And the population mean and the mean is like, is 1,000, right? So two standard deviations below the mean, that's 2 times 100. So two standard deviations below, that's 800. Two standard deviations above, that's 1,200, right? So that means 95% of the population falls within CD4 count number between 800 per millimeter cubed of blood and 1,200 per millimeter cubed of blood, right? So that means 5% must fall outside of this range. 5% must fall outside of the range. So 5% must be like between less than 800, like have like less than 800 with regards to a CD4 count or greater than 1200, right? So because we have two groups that can fall under this 5% category, you essentially need to split that 5% in half, right? So that means there must be 2.5% that has a CD4 count less than 800, and then there must be 2.5% that has a CD4 count greater than 1200. Again, make sure, I promise you, they test this stuff all the time on US MLEs. You better make sure you understand what I just talked about. So let's talk about, take a quick sidebar here and talk about like p-values, right? So the thing is, p-values, right, to essentially use them to express like a probability that, oh, you know what, the results I'm getting from this study I did are entirely by chance, okay? Obviously, you want that p-value to be as low as possible, right? Because the lower the number is, then the more, you know, confident you feel like, oh, yeah, you know what? Because think about it, right? It's like, if the results, I mean, let's take it to an extreme. Let's say the results are, like, you're like, man, the results of this study I did, you know, the results could have, this results could have been obtained by chance, like 50% of the time. Then obviously that study is never going to get published, right? It's going to get like the, once the person that reads the, let's say like the paper reviewer is reading whatever article or whatever you wrote, they'll just toss it in the trash within like 5 minutes, right? You don't want to do that. But compare with a person that says, oh, you know what? There's like a 1% chance that the results I got from this study were obtained by chance, right? People will feel a lot more, you know, confident with that, right? Because you're like, yeah, 50% chance versus 1% chance, right? That makes you feel a lot better because you're like, okay, that means there is a 99% probability that, oh, these results were not obtained by chance. Versus the other one where it's like, oh, a 50% probability where these results were not obtained by chance, right? Obviously, you want to go with the higher probability, okay? So the thing is, the lower your p-value, the more confident you are in the results of a test. Okay, so if you have like a p-value of like 0.05, that is not as good as a p-value of 0.01, because the 0.01 p-value means that there is one chance in 100 that the study results, you get them by chance, versus the one that's like 0.05 where it's like for one, in, you have like a 1 in 20 chance where the results of the test, you are getting them by, like the results you're observing from the study, like due to chance. Okay, so again, very high yield to understand those. And the thing is, if you're not told, basically like the p-value you should always use on MBME questions is 0.05. It's only if they give you a different p-value. If they don't give you any p-values, you don't see any p-values in the question, always use 0.05 because that's what's most commonly used in the scientific community. Okay, so let's go to question 12, right? So question 12 says, four separate drug trials are conducted to test the relative effectiveness of four different 3-beta hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase agonists in raising libido. The mean libido levels in the study with confidence intervals are graphed below. Which of the following statements are true? Okay, so you look at the graph, you can see on the x-axis we have like four drugs, drug 1, 2, 3, and 4. On the y-axis we have libido, right? Low at the bottom, high at the top. And we're essentially, again, comparing average libido levels 3 months after treatment with these different drugs. So here are your answer choices, right, on the next slide, right? So option A says drug 1 is more effective than drug 2. Option B says drugs 3 and 4 are similar in effectiveness. Option C says drug 4 is more effective than drug 2. And option D says drugs 1 and 4 show similar effectiveness. So what do you think the answer here is? Okay, so let's talk about it, right? So the thing is, you kind of want to, again, realize this like general principle, right? With these are confidence intervals. The thing is, whenever you have two confidence intervals cross each other, right? So if like their lines overlap, then that means there is no significant difference between those two things, okay? Again, these scenarios are like super common on the USMLE exams. So really statements A, B, and D should be correct here, right? Because statement A says drug 1 is more effective than drug 2. If you notice, drug 1 gives rise to a higher libido like value than drug 2, and their lines do not intersect, okay? So drug 1 really is in fact more effective than drug 2. Option B says drugs 3 and 4 are similar in effectiveness, Again, if you notice, drugs 3 and 4, their lines, their confidence interval lines cross each other, right? So that tells you that there are no significant differences between drugs 3 and 4. And then option D says drugs 1 and 4 show similar effectiveness. Again, the lines cross for drugs 1 and 4, so there are no significant differences between both. Their effectiveness is essentially the same. Okay. Now, the thing is, they can test this in a graphical format, but they can also test it by giving you just numbers, right? The thing is, they can give you confidence intervals. They can give you confidence intervals of like relative risks or odds ratios or like absolute risk reductions and things like that. Whenever you see those things, you want to be careful. Here's the principle. Whenever you have a biostats quantity that is driven by ratios, that's essentially like a ratio, right? So like odds ratio, relative risk. The thing is, if the confidence interval crosses 1, then you have results that are not significant. So the p-value for those kinds of studies should be greater than 0.05. On the other hand, if you have a quantity that's driven by differences, right? So like the difference between two means, for example, right? Or something like absolute risk reduction. The thing is, the results will be non-significant, right? So you have like p-value greater than 0.05 if the results of your confidence interval crosses 1. So you may say, Divine, why is that the case? Well, here's the thing. If, for example, you have a confidence interval of a relative risk that crosses 1, that means for a relative risk to be 1, it means that the risk, like the risk in your numerator divided by the risk in your denominator, is the same. Because the only way you can get the number 1 from dividing two things is if those two things are the same, right? So that's why if you have like a ratio-driven biostats quantity, if the confidence interval crosses 1, then that quantity, there are no significant differences between the two things you're trying to measure, right? Now, for a difference, right, if the confidence interval crosses 0, there are also no significant differences. So why is that? Again, walk me here for a second. The only way the difference between two numbers ends up being 0 is if those two numbers are the same, right? It's like you can't get 0 from doing 2 minus 3, no. But you can get 0 from doing 2 minus 2, right? So if the confidence interval for like a difference between two things crosses 0, it tells you that those two quantities must be the same, okay? So that's why confidence interval for difference-driven quantities, difference-driven biostats quantities, when they cross 0, it tells you that you have results that are not significant. So let's go on to the next question, right? So we have a study that is done to assess the relationship between vaping in college. And by the way, vaping is a terrible idea. I mean, I'm sure studies are going to come out relatively soon about people getting like really bad lung injury. I've certainly seen a lot of that on the news recently. Okay, so a study is done to assess the relationship between vaping in college and the future need for lung transplant, right? The study yielded a relative risk of 3.5 with a p-value less than 0.05. Which of the following represents a possible 95% confidence interval from this study? Okay, so option A says 0.5 to 3.5. Option B says 2 to 4.5. Option C says 3.5 to 6. Option D says 3.9 to 7.1. And then option E says 0.71 to 3.68. So pause and try to come up with an answer. Okay, so let's talk about this, right? So the thing is, if you look at options A and E are clearly wrong, right? Because notice the confidence interval for options A and E include 1, right? But this study is measuring a relative risk, right? And remember, relative risk is a ratio, okay? The relative risk is a ratio, right? So you cannot have like significant results and have the confidence interval cross 1. That's just flat out wrong, right? If you also look at options A and C are also wrong because if you notice, the relative risk that what we sort of got from the study begins or ends the confidence interval, right? This is literally not possible, right? If you ever get like results from a test, the confidence interval includes the result of that test, but it does not start, right? And this is why it's called a confidence interval in the first place, right? You take that value you get from the test and then like use your Z-scores, and I'll talk about that in a bit. You use your Z-scores to say, oh, this is the range lower than this number I got from the test. This is the range higher than this number I got from the test, okay? So results that you obtained from a study have to be within a confidence interval. They cannot begin or end the confidence interval, right? And then D is clearly wrong again, because again, it does not include the value you got from the study, right? Like the value you got from the study is like a freaking 3.5. You can have a confidence interval that's like 3.9 to 7.1. Where's the value from your study? It's not there. It's not within range, so it cannot be correct. Okay. So the right answer here is actually option B. Okay. 2 to 4.5, because that includes the number you get from your study. Okay. And the confidence interval does not cross 1. Okay. So let's go on to the next question. So we have a study. So a study is done to assess the effectiveness of a new drug D for the treatment of GBM, right? So like glioblastoma multiforme. All patients enrolled in the study received the current standard of care. In addition to receiving standard of care, group A, so this is the experimental group, they received drug D. Group B received standard of care and a sham drug, Y. So that's essentially like a placebo, right? Of the 40 patients receiving D, so drug D, 8 die over the course of the study. On the other hand, of the 40 patients receiving Y, 20 die over the course of the study. So in this question, I'm asking, what is the number needed to treat for drug D? So option A is 2.7, option B is 3.3, option C is 13.3, option D is 5.0, and option E is 15.5. So pause, try to come up with an answer. Okay, so let's talk through this, right? So really, if you ever want to calculate the number needed to treat, right? The big thing you want to remember is you essentially want to find the difference in risk between the patients that were exposed to some intervention and the patients that were not exposed, okay? So you take the difference, and then the number you get from that difference, just divide it into 1. That's all you literally need to do, right? So if you notice, I'm not setting up any 2x2 table or any of that crap. I'm just, again, just reasoning through the concept and arriving at the answer, right? So basically, you ask yourself, what is the risk in people that that got drugged? What's the risk of, like, of death in people that got drugged D? You take that risk. What is the risk of death in people that got drug Y? You take that risk, right? Drug Y is the placebo, it's the sham drug, right? And then you take the difference between those numbers, divide it into 1, and boom, you're home free, right? So basically, right, like the number you need to treat is like 1 divided by your absolute risk reduction, right? So it's like, again, 40 people got drug D, 8 of them died. So like 20% of those people died, right? 40 people got drug Y in addition to standard of care, right? So the drug D people, right, also remember they also got standard of care, right? So, but 40 people got drug Y and 20 of them died within the period. So that's like 50%, right? So the risk difference is like 50 minus 20%. That's 30%, right? If you divide, 30% is like 0.3. If you divide that into 1, then you're left with 0.33, right? You're left with 0.33, right? I mean, sorry, 1 divided by 0.3, that's 3.3. Whoops, sorry about that. That's 3.3, right? And that's the right answer. So the answer here is B. Right? And if you understand the number needed to treat, you know the number needed to harm, right? It's essentially like the same calculation, right? But the thing that happens here is that, like, the rate of harm in the person that gets the drug, like the intervention, tends to be higher than the rate of harm in the person that does not get the intervention, right? So let's say the intervention is like getting, like, I don't know, let's say it's like a drug that ultimately gets pulled off the market. So let's say like 1,000 people, you start them on a drug. I mean, yeah. 1,000 people, you get them into a study, 500 of them, you start them on a drug, 500 you start on placebo, and then like 10% of the people in the group that get the drug die, and 1% of the people in the group that do not get the drug die, right? Then that tells you that it's hazardous to take that drug, right? It's hazardous to take that drug. So like diethylstilbestrol, for example, is probably like a good example of stuff like that, right? So, you may see divine... Too many formulas to remember. Number needed to harm, number needed to treat, blah, blah, blah. How do I remember this? Let me actually give you one rule and then you're set. Essentially, take 1 and divide it by the difference between the risks for whatever two groups you're doing, right? The only thing you just need to make sure you do is try to make sure that you put the higher numbered risk first before the lower numbered risk. So because you always want to get like a positive number from doing like your from doing your risk in exposed versus risk in unexposed. Okay, again, very high yields to understand that. So again, quickly as a sidebar here, right, if you want to calculate relative risk, essentially, you know, just take the risk in people that are exposed divided by the risk in the people that are unexposed, right? So for example, right, so let's say you have like some kind of cohort study where you're comparing like smokers and non-smokers, right? And let's say you put 500, you have 500 people in the smoking group, 500 people in the non-smoking group, right? And let's say 100 people in that smoking group develop lung cancer. But 50 people in the non-smoking group develop lung cancer, right? Essentially, 20% of the people in the smoking group got lung cancer. 10% of the people in the non-smoking group got lung cancer, right? So if you take the relative risk, you divide the risk, you essentially say like risk in people that were exposed divided by risk in people that were unexposed, you get like 20% divided by 10%, which is essentially 2, right? So basically, smoking gives you like a 2-fold increased risk of lung cancer compared with non-smokers, okay? So again, I really hope you understand the relative risk. So let's jump to the next question. So if the presence of dysmorphic erythrocytes in the urine has a sensitivity of 90% and a specificity of 45% for the detection of IgA nephropathy, what is the likelihood ratio of having IgA nephropathy if the patient has dysmorphic erythrocytes detected on urinalysis? Option A, 1.35. Option B, 0.45. Option C, 4.55. Option D, 2.33. And option E, 1.67. So, I'm sure this is probably the question that most people are like, I have no idea what's going on here. So let's sort of talk about likelihood ratios, right? So the thing is, they occasionally pop up on the USMLE. So you kind of want to know about them, right? And many students, they kind of ask me, like many students I tutor, they ask me, Divine, when do I know when to use the positive likelihood ratio formula versus the negative likelihood ratio formula, right? So let me give you a rule that will make your life profoundly simple. Essentially, the thing you do here is if the patient has like a positive result from a test, okay, if a patient has a positive result from a test, use the positive likelihood ratio formula, okay? On the flip side, if a patient has a negative test result from a given test, okay, use the negative likelihood ratio formula, right? So if you have to calculate here, essentially what you do is since the patients, right, if you notice the patient had like positive test results, so because they tell you that, oh, the patient actually does have dysmorphic erythrocytes detected on your analysis, right? So this is one of those formulas that unfortunately you do actually need to commit to memory for the exam, right? So to get the positive likelihood ratio, the thing you essentially do is you take the sensitivity and divide it by 1 minus specificity, okay? So for this question, right, the sensitivity is like 0.9, right? You divide that by 1 minus 0.45. 0.45 is the specificity. That gives you 1.67, okay? So the positive likelihood ratio here is 1.67, okay? Remember, the formula for negative likelihood ratio is like 1 minus sensitivity divided by specificity. I've usually found it easy to just remember 1 and then switch it up, right? Like switch up the, like bring up the 1 for the next one, and then you get the, you are able to build up the equation in your mind. Okay, so let's, I guess, quick sidebar, like what exactly do I mean by likelihood ratios? The thing is, likelihood ratios, I can give like a very lengthy lecture on likelihood ratios. We clearly don't have that time because I'm already at like an hour and 8 minutes. But again, this is, again, if you listen to this podcast, you'll be a biochem master by the end, right? So bear with me. I'll try to be done soon. There's probably like 9 more slides remaining or something like that. So the thing is, likelihood ratios, whenever you calculate like a positive likelihood ratio, you're essentially telling yourself how much more likely, right? How much more likely is a phenomenon given a positive test result? Right? How much more likely is a given phenomenon given a positive test result, right? On the other hand, a negative likelihood ratio essentially tells you how much less likely a phenomenon is when you have a negative test result, right? So how much less likely a phenomenon is when you have a negative test result, right? So again, that it's kind of like if a person comes in, there's this example I love to give that, let's say they tell you like when you're interviewing for med school that, oh, 100% of the, like 50, no, let's not say 100%. Let's say 50% of the students that come into this med school match into DERF, right? And then let's say you come into med school, you take step 2 CK, you take step 1, you get a 280. You get step 2 CK, you get a 280, right? Your chances of matching into DERM are a lot higher than, okay, let me put it this way. I think I said the first part wrong. So let's say, you know, you're interviewing for med school, they tell you that, oh, if you come to this med school, you have a 50% chance of matching into dermatology, okay? You come to this med school, 50% chance you're going into, you're going to be able to, so let's say you applied to DERM, your chances of matching are 50%. Right, and then you come to that med school, you take step 1, step 2, CK, you get 280s on both, right? Clearly, your chances of matching into DERM with those kinds of scores are much higher than 50%. They're probably more like 99 to 100%, right? Assuming you interview well and the other parts of your application are good and you're not like a robot or serial killer or something, right? So, your likelihood ratio has adjusted like in the positive direction, and it's very positive. If you calculated likelihood ratios for those, it would probably be like some really high number, right? Because it's almost like certain, right, that, oh, you're going to match into DERM because you got those positive results, aka getting 280s on both USMLE exams. Okay, now let's go to question 16, right? So in a study examining the relationship between exposure to ketamine and the subsequent development of neutropenia, medical records of 300 children were reviewed. 100 children who were exposed to ketamine were found to have neutropenia. 50% who were exposed to ketamine were found to not have neutropenia. 80 children who were not exposed to ketamine were found to not have neutropenia. And 70 children who were not exposed to ketamine were found to not have neutropenia. What is the odds ratio for this study? Option A, 3.29. Option B, 2.29. Option C, 5.67. Option D, 2.23. And option E, 7.16. So pause and try to come up with an answer. Okay, so let's talk about it, right? Let's talk about it. Right, so the thing is, again, you may see this question and say, oh, divine, this is a question that will easily take me 5-10 minutes on an MBME exam. It does not have to. Okay, if you pay attention to the rule I'll give you like a slightly different formula. It's just a different way of thinking about odds ratios. It'll make your life supremely easy, right? You'll be like, many of, whenever I see odds ratio questions, I can usually get done with them in like 30 seconds to a minute. Okay, so I'll talk you through how I do that. So the thing is, odds ratio, right? So what does an odds ratio mean? It essentially compares the odds of a person with disease having been exposed to a given risk factor compared to the odds of a control being exposed to that same risk factor, right? So the thing is, my own formula for calculating odds ratio, I call it the logical people product divided by the weird people product. So I'll say that again. The logical people product divided by the weird people product. So what in the world do I mean by that? So here's what I define as my logic. These are the people that are logical, right? Because think about it. If you've been exposed to something bad, right, you should expect that you get disease from that thing, right? On the flip side, if you were not exposed, so let's say like, oh, if a person smokes, you should expect that they should be the ones getting lung cancer. If a person does not smoke, you should expect that they should be the ones not getting lung cancer, right? So basically, my logical people product are people that, you know, obey the classic norms that you expect, like logical norms, right? So they're exposed and they're affected, or they are unexposed and unaffected. You multiply those two numbers together. And then for my denominator, the weird people product, those are people that they're just super odd. It's like, let's say, for example, they smoked, but they didn't get lung cancer. Or they did not smoke and they got lung cancer, right? So like exposed and unaffected. And then you multiply that by unexposed but affected, right? That's your weird people product, right? So if you do that for this question, right? You essentially take 100, right? Those are the people that were exposed to, the kids that were exposed to ketamine and got neutropenia, multiplied by 80, right? So those are the people that they were not exposed to ketamine, they did not have neutropenia, And then you divide that by 70, right? 70 represents the people who were, they didn't get exposed to ketamine, but unfortunately, they had a neutropenia. And you multiply that by 50, right? 50 represents the people that were exposed to ketamine, but they actually did not get neutropenia. So logical people product divided by weird people product. And that gives you an answer of 2.29. Okay, good. So let's go on to question number 17, right? So the mean blood glucose level of a group of 81 medical students was 170 milligrams per deciliter with a standard deviation of 15 milligrams per deciliter. Calculate the 95% confidence interval and in words, interpret your results. So let's just sort of talk through this because I don't have multiple choice for this. I was kind of running out of time this morning when I was making these slides. So I started, you'll see at the end, I just summarized some high yield concepts that I just got really tired of making questions from them, because really making these slides and making this podcast certainly takes a very like larger amounts of time than people realize, but that's a different story. I enjoy doing it. It's my passion. It's what I it's one of the things I live for every day. I love teaching people. I've done teaching for more than a decade. I just absolutely love it. I mean, personally, for me, teaching is the best job in the world. I don't know how anyone can ever hate teaching. But anywho, that's a conversation for a different day. So let's walk through this right on the next slide, right? So the mean, right, the average in this question is 170 mg per deciliter, right? The thing is, if you want to calculate confidence intervals, right, you need to calculate the standard error of the mean first. And the thing is, to calculate standard error of the mean, you typically take the standard deviation and divide it by the square root of your sample size. Okay, so you essentially take 15, right, and divide it by the square root of 81, which is our sample size, and we get 1.67. Okay, now the thing is, if you want to calculate standard z-scores, right, I mean, if you want to calculate confidence intervals, you need z-scores, right, and we're dealing with the 95% confidence interval here. So the z-score for a 95% confidence interval is like 2. Again, if you're like, oh, like super particular, it's 1.96, but again, it doesn't make sense to use 1.96 on any exam. Use 2. It's an easier number to multiply by. So you take to get your confidence interval, you essentially take your mean, right? So like 170 plus or minus 2 times your standard error of the mean, which we already calculated as 1.67, right? So you essentially have like 170 plus or minus 3.34. 3.34 is 1.67 times 2, right? 1.6 times 2 is 3.2. 0.7 times 2 is 0.14, right? So 3.2 plus 0.14 is 3.34. That's how I do a lot of my mental math, right? So essentially, you have like 170 minus 1 minus 3.34 or 170 plus 3.34. So your range is like 166.66 to 173.34, right? So how do you interpret this? And again, believe it or not, the MBME has been known to put questions that test confidence interval, and they essentially put interpretations of the confidence interval as answer choices, and then they mix and match things, and then you have to pick out the right interpretation, right? So for this study, you can essentially say with like 95% confidence that the real mean blood pressure of the medical student population, right, falls somewhere between 166.6 and 173.34, okay? Another way you can say this is that, oh, the mean blood pressure for any randomly selected group of 81 medical students will fall somewhere between, again, 166.66 and 173.34, okay? 95% of the time, if you essentially repeat the experiment on multiple locations. Those are just two different ways of expressing the same thing, okay? Again, make sure you know how to calculate confidence intervals and make sure you can interpret them in words, okay? Very important to know those things. So, essentially done with the questions I have. I just want to, you know, summarize some high yield concepts that I've just kind of run out of time to make questions out of. I love writing questions, but writing questions, especially writing good high quality questions, takes ridiculous amounts of time. So I'm just going to do a quick summary here and then we'll be done, right? So remember your ROC curves, right? Classically, right? If you want to pick the best test, right? So the test with the highest combination of sensitivity and specificity, you want to pick a test that is on the uppermost left corner of the graph. Right? And then your cohort studies, again, I already kind of talked about this. You look at two groups of people, they have different exposures, you follow them into the future for the development of an outcome, and you can actually have like a prospective cohort study, or you can have one that's retrospective. The retrospective one, you take two groups of people. One got an outcome, one did not get an outcome. And then you look back to see what kinds of exposures they had, right? For some reason, a retrospective cohort study looks an awful lot like a case control study, okay? But usually, the case control study is used for like very rare phenomena versus cohort studies, especially like the retrospective ones that are used for more common phenomena, right? The retrospective cohort studies are more for like common phenomena. And they tend to have like less recall bias in comparison with case control study, although the odds ratio is usually pretty close to the relative risk when the prevalence of a disease is super, super, super low. Okay. I would encourage you to try to reason that out on your own. And then remember, right, like if you're going like, oh, for a normal distribution, like, oh, like 1, 2, or 3 standard deviations above the mean, right, you want to remember that 68% of the population fall within a 1 standard deviation of the mean, 95% fall within 2 standard deviations, right, and then 99.7% fall within 3 standard deviations, right? So again, how you to know those. And then if you essentially want to compare two groups of people with a test, right, you want to do like the t-test. Remember t for 2, the team t-test for the team 2, right? But if you're comparing more than two groups, you want to use something called the f-test. Sometimes they call it the ANOVA test on MBMEs, right? And then you want to also remember the differences between type 1 and type 2 errors, right? When you incorrectly reject the null hypothesis, so let's say the null hypothesis is actually true, but you actually end up rejecting it, that's a type 1 error. That's an alpha error. But on the flip side, if you incorrectly accept the null, so it's like, let's say like, oh, like you do a study and you say like, oh, smoking does not cause lung cancer. That is not true, right? That is false. Right, so you're saying smoking does not cause lung cancer, you're accepting the null hypothesis and you are incorrectly accepting it. That's a type 2 error, okay? That's a beta error. And remember that power is 1 minus beta, right? And beta errors have to do with power, and I'll talk about that in a second, right? Now the thing is, whenever you have tight confidence intervals, your study is a lot more precise. When you have tight confidence intervals, your study is a lot more precise. But you should feel a lot less confidence though with the results of that study, right? Because you essentially have very little room for error. Because think about it, right? If, for example, a person offers, they say, oh, you know what? Do you want to take this bet? This bet pays out $1 million. And in this bet, you're betting that the temperature of today is going to fall somewhere between 101.1 and 101.3. You probably wouldn't want to take that bet because it's like there's a much larger range of temperatures that fall outside those parameters, right? So you will likely get screwed. Versus someone that tells you, oh, you know what, I'm going to pay you off $1 million if you can predict the temperature for today. And I'm, if it falls between like 50 degrees and 150 degrees, I'll pay out $1 million. Obviously, you'll take that bet without thinking twice because you know your chances of success are a lot higher, right? So you feel a lot less confident in the results of a study when you have very narrow confident intervals. I mean, confidence intervals, okay? Now, how can you increase power? This slide is floridly high yield to know for the USMLE Step 1. If you're taking, not just Step 1, if you're taking any of the USMLEs and you don't know this concept on this slide, you're essentially shooting yourself in the foot, right? So let's talk about different means of increasing power, right? So one thing you can do is you can just recruit more people for a study, right? The more people you recruit, the more you more closely approximate the population you're trying to study, right? And the thing is, if you really do think about it, if you have if you recruit more people for a study, if the effect size is small, you'll still be able to capture it because there's just so many people. I kind of think of it as like you like taking a dollar from every single person that walks by a street that you live on, right? Almost like a toll road. Toll roads are profitable because, yeah, it may be a dollar that they collect on each toll road, although that's not exactly true on the East Coast. The East Coast, they just gimp people for money. But that's a different conversation for a different day. But if you're getting a dollar from every car that passes a toll road and 1 million cars pass that toll road a day, you've just made $1 million, right? So the more people you recruit for a study, the more powerful your study becomes, right? Another way you can increase the power of a study is to essentially have a large difference between the two quantities you're trying to measure, right? So again, you're essentially like having a larger effect size. If you have a larger effect size, then you don't need a ton of people to, you know, make that study work, right? It's like, oh, let me compare the intelligence between two people, between two groups of people. And one group, the average test score is 99. And then the other group, the average test score is 100. The effect size is like one, right? You likely will not get significant results from that test, right? Even if those people have like, you know, like a difference in intelligence, but the difference, like the effect you're trying to capture is so minute and you have so few people, right, that you are not able to get much from that study, right? So, but imagine if you're comparing two groups of people and one group, the average score on a test is 25%. The other group, the average score is 100%. There's clearly a large difference. I mean, there is an obvious difference in those people, right? Like one group is clearly smart. The other group, you know, they need to study a little harder than they have, right? So if you have a large effect size, that can also increase the power of a study, right? And then another thing that can increase the power of a study is that if you have like many of your, like a lot of your data sort of like clustering around like one central value, if you have that, it means your study is like you're super precise, like you're measuring things like really well. Because think about it, if you measure things really well, that means you are capturing any differences that exist at a high level, right? So whenever you have super like precise measurements, you're increasing the power. You're also increasing the power of your study. In fact, if you have very accurate measurements, you're also increasing the power of your study. Remember, accuracy is very different from precision. Accuracy means how close are you to the true value. Precision means for the multiple values you measure, like let's say you measure the same thing over and over and over and over again, do you get reproducible values, right? So do you measure something as 1.5 and then you measure it against like 1.49, you measure it again 1.48, you measure it again 1.51. That's a precise study. But if, for example, the true value of that test is 1.8, your test, your measurements are precise, but they're not accurate because you're like way off from the true value. But let's say you measure a value and it's like 1.79, right? And another one is 1.73, another one is 1.85. Those values are not precise because they don't, you know, they don't cluster around each other really well, but they are accurate because they are very close to the true value. And again, right, again, the more confident, if you are more precise in your measurements, chances are you made the measurements without leaving anything to chance. So your p-values are very low, right? So whenever you do a study and you have lower p-values, that makes your study have more power than one that has higher p-values. And then for the next slide, right? So this is, I believe, third to the last slide, right? So this is another thing. It's kind of obvious, but people, for whatever bizarre reason, tend to get these wrong on the USMLEs. You need to remember that the fact that something is statistically significant, right, doesn't mean that it's clinically significant, right? So, it doesn't mean that, a drug, I do my trial, my p-value is less than 0.05, so I'm going to bring this drug to market. No, it doesn't mean that it's clinically significant, right? So think about it. Let's say like, you do a study, right, or you do a randomized control trial, and the baseline blood pressures of people at the beginning of the trial is like 130 over 80. And then like 2 years after you've completed the trial, they've gotten this antihypertensive agent, their blood pressure is reduced to 129 over 79, right? And let's say, you do like your calculations, you do your confidence intervals, you do your P, you get like significant results, p-values less than 0.01. That's good. That's a statistically significant result, but that drug is useless because it's not clinically significant, because it only lowered your systolic blood pressure by one in a two-year period, and diastolic blood pressure by one in a two-year period. That's a useless drug, right? And then, just again, kind of like some basic things, remember, right? Mean is the average, median is the middle number, right? It's essentially like if you have like an odd numbered set of data, right? So let's say you have like seven values in a set. You parse three values at the beginning, three values at the end. The number in the middle is the median. And then the mode essentially represents the most frequent quantity in your data set, right? And the thing I'll tell you, right, if you're given a set of numbers, they very likely won't do this on an MBME because that's too easy. If you're given a set of numbers, arrange them in ascending or descending order before you start talking about like mean, median, mode, okay? And remember that the mean is affected by extreme values in the set. Okay, so let's say a bunch of people, let's say like there are 10 people that take the USMLE Step 2 CK exam and 9 of them get like 210s, but one person gets like a 300, That's obviously going to skew the results, right? That's going to skew the mean. The mean will appear to be higher than it truly is. It won't be very representative of the population, right? Because there's this one person that just scored out of this world, okay? So that's something you absolutely want to make sure you keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then going to the second to the last slide here, right? So if you have a normal distribution, right, you definitely want to remember that the mean, median, and mode are all the same. That's what makes it a normal distribution in the first place, right? And then remember that, just remember this in like almost like ascending alphabetical order. So like mean has EA, precedes median, that's ED, which precedes mode, right? Like OD, right? So mean precedes median, which precedes mode, right? That's the alphabetical order. If you remember that, that will help you remember what obtains with a negatively skewed or a positively skewed curve, right? Whenever you have a negatively skewed curve, it means like the kind of like the flat portion of the curve is off to the left, right? You're just, again, just write your letters out, mean, median, mode, and then put a lot of less than signs in between. So the mean is less than the median, which is less than the mode. Positively skewed curve, flat portion is on the right. Same thing, write out mean, median, mode, but put greater than signs between those. So mean is greater than median, which is greater than the mode. And then sometimes your friends at the MBME can give you like, you know, they can give you like a curve that shows like a bimodal distribution. And then they will give you answer choices that say which of the following phenomena best represents the curve shown above, right? And then they'll list like a bunch of like random crap, like Hodgkin's lymphoma, something like Burkitt's lymphoma, slow and fast accelerators, blah, blah, blah. You certainly want to remember at least these two high yield examples of things that are associated with bimodal distributions, right? So what do I mean by bimodal? It means there are two things, almost like two peaks. There are two things that are show up commonly. So like Hodgkin's lymphoma, for example, Hodgkin's lymphoma shows up in very young kids, and then you don't see it for a long time again. And then there's this big uptick when people get older. Okay, that's a bimodal distribution. Another common one is like suicide, right? Like suicide, like, is very high in like young people, but also very high in old people, right? It's lower in middle-aged people. That's another example of something that follows a bimodal distribution. And then like a lead time bias, essentially it's like kind of like thinking, it's like erroneous thinking. It's like, oh, survival has improved. When in fact, like, the survival actually improved because you found the disease early, right? I kind of think of it like prostate cancer is a great example. It's like, oh, let's say you start, you know, you check a 40-year-old guy, you find prostate cancer, you detect it, you treat it, and then this 40-year-old guy dies at 85, and you're like, oh, yes, by detecting, by doing this test, I've improved survival in prostate cancer. No, that is not true. Chances are that guy may have lived to the age of like 85 with that prostate cancer, without like necessarily dying from it, right? So don't mistake detecting something early for improved survival. That's classic lead time bias. Again, like I said, I'll talk about bias. I'll likely make a future podcast that talks about lead time bias, and then we'll go from there. So as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, right? So step one, 2CK, 2CS, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year clerkship shelf exams, if you're a medicine resident, the medicine in training exam, the medicine board exams, I do tutor a ton of people for those. And then if you're a college student and you need tutoring in like physics, gen chem, ochem, physiology, histology, biochemistry, I offer tutoring for all those things. And then the longitudinal tutoring that I offer for people starting out med school through their dedicated period, and people that are starting third year through their dedicated period for step 2CK, if you're interested in any of those things, reach out to me. It's something I've done with a decent number of people, and the essentially all of them have been like wildly successful on their USMLE exams, and they've also crushed their preclinical and third year shelf exam. So if that's something you're interested in, just send me an email, just in the heading, just write longitudinal tutoring, and again, I can try to point you in the right direction. Essentially what I do is I meet with these people like once or twice every week throughout their first and second years, and as I'm meeting them, I'm tutoring them for all their block exams. And but at the same time, I'm infusing them with step one knowledge, and also like giving them like guided practice through like MBME style questions that ultimately, like, when they get to their dedicated periods, like, they feel very confident and very ready for the exam, right? Same thing with third years. They start out, and then I teach them like stuff that's pertinent to, like, I prepare them for all their shelf exams, and then they get to their dedicated peers, they feel like super ready. I mean, there are people I've tutored that have gotten to their dedicated peers and they're like, I feel very ready for my exam. So if that's something you're interested in, reach out to me. Either send me an email, reach out through the website, or send me an email. I'll actually list the email here, divineinterventionpodcasts with an S at the end at gmail.com. And then if you need one-on-one coaching or advice in for like ERAS applications for med students applying to residency, or AMCAS applications for college students applying to med school, feel free to reach out. Again, I have a ton of experience with this stuff. So like mock interviews, personal statements, the experiences section of these applications, stuff like that, writing rec letters, I can certainly help you out with any of these things. Again, I've done it with tons of people. I have a lot of admissions committee experience, so take that for what you will. Okay, so I do hope you get something from this podcast. Please, 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 if you're taking any USMLE exam, listen to this podcast. I promise you, it will help you a ton on the exam. So I wish you a wonderful rest of the day. Have a blessed rest of your day, and God bless you. I'll see you in episode 144. Thank you.